unfortunately, more people were buying stocks at the end of last year while it was at a high. And unfortunately, now more people are selling, taking these unrealized losses and realizing them.
Yeah.
As opposed to flipping it and being contrarian, where you go back and look at back historicals, like, hey, this is what we knew to do at the time. But when we go back in time, yeah, we probably would have pivoted, not have realized that loss, kept it as an unrealized loss in the properties, rented them out, enjoy that cash flow, and then maybe then the time was right for you guys. If it looked pretty on paper, then sell it for profit. So it was a good learning lesson. And you guys survived.
You're listening to the Engineer of Finance podcast with Ken Green. Please stay tuned to the end of the episode to hear boring yet important disclosures. Thank you.
Hi, this is Ken Green, the host of the Engineer of Finance podcast, and I have a guest on. His name is Pete Reese. He is the founder of Turning Profit and also the founder of Real Vest Properties and one of your investment companies. Pete, say hi to everyone.
Hey, how's it going, everyone?
And hopefully,
good to be here with you, Ken.
Hopefully, I just said that right. Did I say that?
You said it all. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's fun. I just got back from a business trip, but I brought my 6-year-old son and my wife with me. And so just got back from a great trip, a little jet lagged. And what a great way to start off this week and have a nice guest come on the show. I'm always craving to have more and more guests come on. And it's going to be a fun real estate theme because I had Dave Larson on, I believe, in the previous episode talking about real estate. He's kind of the 1031 guru. And now I have another real estate guru. So if you can, inform me a little bit about your background and when listening about what Turning Profit's about and what you do in real estate, your background. It would be nice to hear.
Sure.
It sounds like you and your wife, Heather Reese, are serial entrepreneurs.
That's right. So since the day we were married, pretty much.
You got that bug, which is great. And I think years ago, I did a podcast talking about 1 + 1 = 3, that if you and your significant other, which your spouse, which is your ultimate business partner, when you're in alignment, you're going to be at least 3 times more profitable. And so
it's an unfair advantage, really. Yeah, I feel.
That's married men are richer than single men typically. Some stat I read recently. So as long as you stay married. And it's pretty neat that you guys are in alignment and working in synergy and you're both entrepreneurs. So yeah, talk about what you do in real estate, your history, and what Turning Profit's about. And your investment company, Real Vest Properties. It would be nice to hear.
Sure. I will start from the beginning, our roots in real estate. We're like a lot of people. When we got married, one of our first goals was to buy a home. And so I think at the time that we're in San Diego County, California, things have always been a little expensive here, way more so now than they used to be. But at the time, we were looking for an entry-level home. We found one that we liked that was a for sale by owner. Paid $195 for it. Had them wrap in.
What year is it?
This was 2000. So we got married in 99. So this is year 2000. It was $195. It was a standard 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 1700 square foot home. And it was, had them wrap in some closing costs, did an FHA loan, 3.5% down. And we were able to get in like with very little money out of pocket. And things changed in our lives. We had a baby on the way. So we decided, hey, let's move in with your parents. So we decided to move in with her parents for a little bit. And we rented out that place for a year. We decided at the time that we didn't want to be landlords because we had some issues with our tenants. Another lesson learned there. But aside from that, we decided to sell it. And then I think we sold it for something like $265 2 years later. We were at the time, this is great. We pocketed $50,000 or after closing costs and that type of thing. And it was like a big chunk of change for us at the time. And we felt like we really didn't do anything aside from paying our mortgage, which was very similar to what a rental payment would have been at that time. So it was an eye-opening moment for us. We bought another house, started fixing that up. And then we decided, hey, we did so well in this first home, we should maybe flip some houses because I know flipping homes are really big now, but it was actually big back then too. There was a lot of shows on HGTV that were going into these things. We got the bug for that. We actually bought a home with 100% financing. It was one of those 80-20 loans at the time. And we ended up selling it without really even doing anything to it, cleaning it up before our first mortgage payment was due. So that was another kind of like eye-opening thing for us. Like I think on that one, we probably made like $75,000 without even making a payment and 100% financing, which you can't do these days. But at the time, financing was pretty easy. So after those kind of things, we really got the bug. And then we decided, hey, let's just do this full time. We started getting into flipping homes. We did really well with it. The market in Southern California and across all the country really just took a huge nosedive, I guess you could say. And values around here went down about 50% overnight. We were pretty lucky. We got out of like the investments that we were holding in things. I lost a couple of them. But
was this 06, 09?
I think 07-ish, 08, like where it really started to hit the fan around here. But we made it out of there. I guess I glossed over one part, which I realized in flipping homes, I realized I was giving up a big percentage of my profits by not, you know, like representing myself as a real estate agent. So I got my broker's license and to try to save money in that. And it worked well. And I felt like I had more control over the transaction and it was good. And then I started representing other people, other investors that I knew, other clients. And that took me down a whole nother tangent. But it was good when the real estate market crashed because we decided it was not the time to be flipping homes. But we decided, hey, I can do this. I can represent the banks. So I got really heavily involved into selling REO properties. So basically being a listing broker for the banks when they foreclosed on properties. It was a crazy time. And it's not something that I would really recommend if you're looking for a really fulfilling career and sell bank-owned properties. It was tough, like emotionally, it's tough because you deal with the people going through that as well. So it's
the ones that are losing. Well, can you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like the first thing they do is like when a bank forecloses on a home, they send you an email that says, hey, new property assignment. And you have to go down and knock on the door. And then see if anyone's living there. And if they are living there, you open up a discussion. Like the bank wants you to offer cash for keys, they call it. So their goal is to get the property as vacant as quickly as possible so they can sell it. But then on the other side, you're dealing with real human beings that are going through a lot of tough things at the time. And it's just a real tough balancing act and something that I struggled with. I didn't enjoy it at all, but had to do what I had to do in order to bring in income at the time. Yeah, so we got past that whole stage. I ended up working with a lot of investors, finding investment deals for them. So we were doing that for quite some time. I really learned about what they're looking for. I was able to find them deals so they were happy with me. And so that was a good niche for me for a while. But also we got heavily involved. My wife in about 2012, she started up a blog, lifestyle and travel blog. And she really grew that to really a big thing. And for a while there, we were traveling for a period of about 5 years straight. We were traveling 150 days out of the year as a family. So I've got three girls. So we've got a family of five of us. And we were traveling 150 days out of the year doing this. So it was very interesting. Then we had a whole business that started off of that, training business for showing people how to start a blog, how to start a travel blog, how to work with brands and everything else associated with that. So that was like about a 5 year detour for us as a family out of the real estate world. I got the itch to get back into real estate. And that's when we started RealVest Properties. And what we do is primarily we buy and sell land. And for the most part, these are short-term holds. So we buy a piece of land, do minor improvements, do some development things sometimes, and then resell them as quickly as possible. So that's the business we're in now. That's RealVest Properties. Also, we are starting a new podcast called Turning Profit, where we'll be looking really deeply into different real estate investing business models, going in as deeply as possible, because there's a lot of different ways to make money in real estate. But one thing I've learned over time is you really need to pick one and focus on it and go all in on it in order to be successful. Otherwise, you're just dabbling here and there. And it's tough to become an expert in everything and do it right.
Yeah. Well, I look forward when the podcast comes out because people listen to the show for quite some time. Real estate is one of my favorite areas to invest, right?
Yes.
Wall Street's always been, stock market's always been a bright and shiny object for me. And I think great diversification is you have a portion on the stock market, a portion in real estate, a portion of money in a bank of source or two, and a portion of money hiding under a mattress. Right? That's true diversification, not a certain percentage in a bond portfolio and equities. It's just having stuff on Wall Street, stuff off Wall Street, and having it all work in synergy. And so the real estate, it's interesting with real estate. You have to be a unique You definitely have to be a little bit of a danger seeker to enjoy flipping homes. You have to be a little crazy. So I've met some great entrepreneurs flipping homes, and they have a unique skill set. They're able to assemble great teams around them and be a little crazy and live in these homes. It's pretty interesting. You bought your first home. You bought it, and then you moved in with your parents.
Yeah. My wife's parents. My mother-in-law, of all things. That's crazy in itself.
With a little one that was born around the way, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My wife had some problems with some complications with her pregnancy. So at the time, it was like very appealing that, hey, we can move in with them. We'll be able to save some money. We'll be able to get some help with the baby. And it just seemed like a really good move. In reality, it was a year living with my mother-in-law. No, she's fine. She's good. I would say that if she was here. But it's tough being a young couple and being in that situation. We did save some money and we were able to buy a little bit better house as a result.
Was that your mother-in-law's idea or was it your guys' idea to...
I believe she offered it up and we thought, oh, that's interesting.
No, yeah. That's great. You guys are brave. And that was awesome for your parents to do it. And it's also pretty awesome. Your first home, you didn't even live in it. You rented it and used it for an income stream and profit on it.
We lived in it for a year and then we rented it out for a year. So
now the flipping home piece, because they're a little bit different now, what's going on than what happened. I was really big into land development, being a professional engineer, love land development, love real estate, and being a part of that. And then that's how I got into the financial industry, is when all of a sudden I'm on the corner sale engineer for food. It just all stopped. And for the first time in my life, I experienced deflation. Watching a house on a piece of paper in 06, supposing a piece of paper were $450, and a couple of years later, no one would even buy it for $175.
Yeah, crazy. Amazing. I know.
And so you got to live through that a little bit. I remember going to real estate investment clubs years ago just to learn what a lot of landlords do and learn what the community is doing here locally. And so a lot of brilliant minds show up just to share what their experiences are. These clubs can be really fun. And I remember one person, he was talking about one of his stories. He had 100 homes, all leveraged, and lost every single one, right? When we went through, it's just amazing how that can really bite you. Now, with the flipping home piece, it sounded like you guys survived. It sounded like it did real well. You're a little crazy, but probably had a really good team and ambitious. And obviously, both believed in each other and what you're doing in the community. Finding these homes, improving them, selling, flipping them to create that income. And did it bite you in the butt a little bit, or did you come out?
A little bit. We lost some money. But it could have been a lot worse than what it ended up being. We weren't holding like 100 homes at a time or anything like that. We were like 2 or 3 at a time. And at the end there, when things were starting to really hit the fan, we realized we need to be a little cautious here. So we weren't going as full bore into that as we could have been. So I think we were fortunate in that. In hindsight, I think I'd be able to see things coming from a lot farther away than I did at the time, because there was a lot of smart people that didn't see that whole crash coming. In hindsight, you look back and you say, how could no one see that thing coming? Because it was like all the writing was on the wall in hindsight. But at the time, I think everyone was in this euphoric state and everyone thought the party was going to keep going forever. Obviously, it didn't. And it crashed and burned. And it was a major life event for many people, especially those in the real estate or construction world or engineer like you were. Like, it was just everything related to real estate was just fell off a cliff kind of overnight.
It was unnatural. I remember going into my boss at the time saying, hey, we really need to start having more of a focus on public works projects, which we, in that initiative came into play. But there's a parasite host relationship, right? So when the government can't collect any money from one, they stop their public works projects too. It was just insane. I remember in my neighborhood, a house would be on the market. It sold, and 2 days later, the new buyers were selling it.
Crazy.
To make money. Yeah. This is not natural. This can't be sustainable. And for you guys, so it's just to survive that, were you just very strategic on, was it more skill at the time saying, hey, just educate decisions. So you know what, we'll take these hits just to prevent further hits.
Yeah, it was out of necessity because we didn't think ahead enough. I mean, I look back on things we've done and I think, how could I not be thinking like, I was playing checkers instead of chess. I wasn't thinking 2 steps ahead. I was just thinking what was in front of me. And we didn't, our only exit plan was like sell the thing. But any of the properties we bought was to sell them. That was our exit plan. But now when we buy, I try to look at it as multiple exit plans. If exit plan A doesn't work out, what would exit plan B or what would exit plan C be? Like in hindsight, we probably should have just rented some of those places out and just held on to them, even if we were close to being able to pay, if we were close to being able to pay the mortgage with the rents, then it probably just should have held on to some of them or done some creative things like lease options, finding buyers that way or something. But so we took some hits, but they weren't terrible. And we didn't have too many that we really did horrible on, but it did put an end to that business that was our income for that time period. So we had to really make that shift and say, okay, what am I going to do to make money? Because at that point in time, I didn't have this huge nest egg build up where that we could live off of it for a while. It was like, needed to find something else that brought in the income. Thankfully, I had my real estate license, and my wife was like, hey, what's selling are the bank owned properties. So why don't we get into that?
Yeah, let's go represent them. It's a smart
move. Yeah. So we did. One of the things associated with that is they call them BPOs, which is our broker price opinions. And since I was a broker, I could sign up to get these. Basically, they're mini appraisals. And at the time, there was just a whole market built around that. Like these banks were trying to get an idea of what these homes that they had on their books now, what they were worth. And there was this whole industry that built up around these BPOs. So they would send out these assignments. And I think at the time we were getting anywhere from $50 to $100 for each one of these BPOs that we did. So exterior BPO, as they call it, would be like drive by a house, take some pictures, and then you write up a little mini report and give your estimate of the value. Then they'd have ones that were interior BPOs. I think they paid you $100 or something like that. And then you'd have to go inside the house, take pictures, and do another little mini report. But anyhow, we kept the lights on doing that. She would sit at her computer and grab as many of these assignments as possible. And she would be my data entry person. I would write up the opinion. And then we were hiring someone to go out and take the pictures for us. So we built a whole little mini business around that. But that wasn't making us rich, but it was keeping the dollars coming in, at least what we needed to have at the time. So I'm thankful for that. But that led to doing more listings for banks, which were obviously the big chunks when you sell them as a commission. But crazy time.
Yeah, it's interesting. The learning experiences, you go back. I've talked about this, I'm sure, in previous episodes, and mentors have told me and say, Ken, it's not a failure if you learn from it.
That's right.
I defined in the past with me being a big failure. I was like, no, it's just real expensive learning lessons. And I think just a month or so ago, I was talking about we're going through quite the correction. A lot of people were not prepared for the volatility in the stock market, right? And like real estate just seems like it's supposed to go up and up and up.
Yeah.
You look at historically, you know, it likes to get volatile and it's not, it likes to, we know it's going to go up, down, or sideways tomorrow. And it likes to, it's great when it behaves, but then when we go through these periods of corrections, as unnatural as it might seem, unfortunately, more people were buying stocks at the end of last year while it was at a high. And unfortunately, now more people are selling, taking these unrealized losses and realizing them.
Yeah.
As opposed to flipping it and being contrarian, where you go back and look at back historicals, like, hey, this is what we knew to do at the time. But when we go back in time, yeah, we probably would have pivoted, not have realized that loss, kept it as an unrealized loss in the properties, rented them out, enjoy that cash flow. And then maybe then the time was right for you guys. If it looked pretty on paper, then sell it for a profit. So it was a good learning lesson. And you guys survived. And it was brutal for me. It was a lot of human beings. Brutal.
Yep.
And now we're going to this year. It's interesting timing. San Diego, what are you seeing in your community now with real estate? It went from a seller's market. We're seeing here locally in the Reno, Tahoe area, and it's a similar experience in California and a lot of areas and cities where a house goes on the market and there's 15 to 20 people all trying to outbid each other. What's going on now in San Diego? Because it's a beautiful city.
Yeah.
What are you kind of seeing in your community? What's going on now with interest rates at a 20-year high over 7%?
Yeah, 7% now. Crazy. It's interesting. It still seems like there is pretty strong demand here. I do notice that things are staying on the market a little bit longer, but the market hasn't really fallen off much. The pricing, maybe a 10% correction in certain price ranges, but it's hard to say like that. That's only maybe in higher end homes where we notice that, I think. The sort of affordable housing here in San Diego, which is, it's all relative because nothing's really affordable here in San Diego.
What do you define as affordable San Diego? Like 600,000?
As a kind of a side note, I had to, there's this area here by the beach, it's called Encinitas. And it's a cool little town. It's on the beach. It's a very expensive area now, though. It didn't used to be crazy like this, but we're always looking for a good deal or whatever. But I saw this one listing come up. I think it was a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 1,500 square foot home, built in the 50s. Needs to be updated. It's a very small lot, a mile from the beach, so not even that close to the beach. And the description from the listing agent was just like laughable. They said, here's your great first-time homeowner home or your starter home or something like that. In the description, I was like, this is $2.5 million. I don't know what kind of reality these people are living in where they're saying this is a starter home, first-time buyer. Really? Okay. Nuts. Well,
yeah, no, I think it's a bit of a disconnect. And it is subject to the term affordable housing. And I can't remember, I was reading an article last week, just affordable homes really affordable. It's just gotten a little bit insane. And of course, with interest rates over doubled in just under a year, not so affordable. Do you notice anything different than what we experienced back and going through 06, 07, 2008? What feels different to you this time? Obviously, we have this huge interest rate increase, which, yeah, it's at a 20-year high. However, you go back further in time, it's not that bad. But what feels different to you? And I can tell you here locally, in like in the Reno area, the developers, and by the way, developers are very similar to flippers. You got to be semi-crazy. It's a lot of risk. Making decisions today about what you think 2 to 3 years out, you got to just be an incredible optimist. It's like the extreme of entrepreneurs, in my opinion.
Seriously.
Developers, even more than flippers. But what I've noticed is back then in 2004, 2005, and I might have the years off a little bit, but there's just this huge pedal to the metal strategy, build and build a lot, right? When in doubt, just hit the pedal. And so there's just such a huge amount of inventory that was created where they learned, we've experienced here, is that there's still very limited inventory in the Reno, Tahoe
area. Yeah, here too.
And so they've created this kind of scarcity by being very deliberate and being very intentional as they purchase and not so aggressive. And so that's what you experienced as well.
Yeah, the thing that really feels different, like the inventory is definitely, I'm sure, a big reason for this, but it felt like back then that things just went off a cliff. And there's an area up here, it's actually in Riverside County, just north of San Diego County. It's called Temecula Murrieta area. It's one big area. The homes there, it felt like there was a drop. It felt like they dropped 50% in 30 to 60 days, like list prices. Like it just went off a cliff back then, that is. Now, I think we're seeing some decrease in pricing values, but it's more of like a gradual, like a big cruise ship turning. It's turning gradually. Back then, it's just like it fell off the edge of the earth. It's one of those things. But I think things are obviously going in that direction, especially as we get rates higher and higher. It knows that's the direction it's going. But it's just not nearly going as fast. And probably the inventory has a lot to do with that.
No, not if I understood correctly, not a strong focus for you at this time. I can't wait to talk about the flipping undeveloped property because that's really interesting. Yeah. That's an interesting animal too.
Yeah.
Banks says you don't like undeveloped property. There's no structure. It's like the most foreign topic in the world. Why would they ever lend money when there's no residence on it? That makes no sense to them. And so it's a very interesting animal. I just thought I'd ask you the flipping side with your flipping hat on, the experience you have. What would your, if you're giving guidance or ideas for people who want to flip properties right now, would you have some hesitancy to that flipping at this moment? Would you tell people to pause and wait for opportunities, build up liquidity because some opportunities will seek them out soon? What would your advice be to the little crazies out there that love.
Yeah, really. For flipping homes, I think there's definitely opportunity still, especially if you're working in a market where there is those tailwinds behind you. You know, there's a lot of in that area, and it seems like the area itself is growing. I think if you have that tailwind behind you, it makes it a little bit less risky. If you're going in an area that just jumped up really heavily, like I'd be real concerned about some of the markets, like South Florida or maybe Vegas right now, or some of those areas that really took a big leap. Phoenix, maybe. I don't know. Like some of those areas that took a really big leap up in the past few years and then getting into flipping now, it might be a little bit difficult there. But if you're in an area that's growing industry-wise, big companies moving there, and just the general trend, maybe not just some place that has had a sharp rise lately, you can, I think, do okay. But the one thing that I think is important is to maybe look at things with the second exit strategy. Like it's possible that your flip may not work out, may not be the most ideal thing ever. If that happens, are you going to be able to hold it with a tenant in place or turn it into a short-term rental or turn it into a midterm, like 30-day furnished rental? Or like, how would you make it work if you can't sell it? Yeah. So, or if you can't sell it for that price that you need.
Yeah, no, that's great. I got to ask you about the undeveloped property. Oh, I have one more thing on you're talking about representing investors for real estate.
Yes.
I find that really interesting. I don't get them as often, but it seems like, oh no, that's not true. I get text messages all the time and letters about how they're representing their investors and they love to pay cash for the house.
Yes.
And get this great deal on cash and they'll actually let us stay in the house and rent it back too.
Oh, yes.
And I was like, okay, I don't have the time to go pick up the phone, although I should, and say, hey, I know what the house is worth, but see what great offer that these real estate agents are going to get for me representing the investors they're representing. I highly doubt I'm going to get what I think it's worth, but what's that look like, a mind share for the investors you're representing? What are they looking for typically when it comes to investing in real estate?
When I was representing investors before, I was mainly dealing with investment companies. And for the most part, I was actually finding them deals off of the MLS. And they would authorize me to write offers on their behalf as long as it met their criteria. So that's what I was doing every morning. I would see what kind of new listings came out. I'd be evaluating things all over the county, really, that maybe had been on the market for a while and, you know, could stand a price reduction or something that I saw about them where I thought there might be some opportunity. So it was a lot of phone calls with other agents trying to build rapport, like things that were under contract maybe right away, but it was an investment fixer type property, and just letting them know, hey, if this deal falls out, I've got people to step in and get this thing closed right away. Be amazed how many deals I picked up that way.
Not so amazed. I think that's very smart. And the mind share and the commission focus, right?
Yeah.
That's just all that work these realtors put in to close. And I shouldn't just say realtors, right? Real estate agents is probably more appropriate term. But, you know, they put a lot of work into this and then they're not getting paid until they deliver.
That's right.
And
it's got to sell.
If it falls through, I could see them picking up the phone and calling Mr. Reese.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get this closed. 2 weeks, we'll be done.
Oh, that's it, right. 2 weeks. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
People who can write a check that don't have to go through this laborious process of a home loan.
And yeah, so definitely.
It's amazing how opportunities will seek you out when you just have cash sitting idle.
That's right. That's right.
The undeveloped property. So I was so proud when I bought my 40 acres of land, and those are my 20s. And in north area of Reno, Spanish Springs, Nevada, I was super proud of my 40 acres. And but banks don't like vacant land. They don't like giving loans on it. They don't like help you buying them. And also, you have a very limited market too. You go throw a property out there that's a single family residence or a duplex, you're going to have a lot of people, definitely if it's single family, interested in buying. It's just you have a way big pool. When you just have undeveloped property, way less buyers. Potentially, it's just not as interesting. And so it's very interesting to me that you're flipping undeveloped properties.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's a completely different business model. It's not done in the way I think that a lot of people would assume. We do buy some properties that we end up holding for a while and going through the preliminary subdivision process, or, you know, getting it at least sketch plan on paper, or maybe taking steps in that direction. But the great majority of the properties are ones that we buy and then we do some minor stuff to it. Like we get a perk test done, we do some brush clearing, we'd get a survey done, something like that. And then we put it right back on the market and resell it. So the whole key to that.
Did you say survey? Was that the last thing you said?
Survey. Sometimes we'll get a survey done. So
what kind of survey?
Just from a surveyor. Like it depends on the market that we're working at. Some of these areas, there may never have been like an actual survey done on the property. So it's like a meets and bounds type legal description, something like that, which is.
So you'll get corners marked then? So you actually.
Yeah, get corners marked. And sometimes the legal description will say this on the north side, it goes to the big rock by the Joe Smith property. And then it's bordered on the other side by this stump at Clara Mabel's house. It's funny, but that's just the way those things are done. And then the surveyor will go out and instantly that creates a little bit of value if you can get that defined. But really the business plan is to buy things off market and to buy them at a good price to give us room to be able to maybe do a little improvement on the property and then resell it at a good price. So we can then market it to an end buyer that looks at this and said, this is a good deal. This is 20% below retail and I'll buy it. So that's the nuts and bolts of it, but pretty simple improvements sometimes, but key is buying right and then being able to resell it at a good price. So
now in the last couple of years, trying to get quotes with different surveyors in my area, the range in quotes is very interesting to me.
Yeah.
Some feasible, some are just redanned. Yes. Also, I always joke like surveyors are like nomads. They just love, they'll show up when they show up.
Yeah, I know.
And has that been your experience? Is that a decent way to describe it?
Yeah. And in fact, most of the markets that we deal in, the surveyors are so busy. So it adds an extra layer of complexity. It's just that like most of them just don't even want the work. They don't want to answer the phone. They don't want to return. It's, I guess, anything related to real estate. It's like that now, construction, real estate, any of these service providers. So it's really key to when you find an area that you like, is to really try to build up those vendors in those areas that you can rely on that you know are going to give you a reasonable price, do good work, and get out there as quickly as possible.
Now, on the flip, so I assume you've created some pretty good relationship in that space where you've got a few key people you can go to. And are you focused in a certain region? Is it just the San Diego area when it comes to flipping land? Or
no, in fact, your fingers? Most of our stuff is all over the country. A lot of stuff on the East Coast, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, lots of different, then some stuff in California, Washington State, all over, and in California, but I don't focus at all in California at this point. So it's tough. There's not many areas that are really work with this business model. And there's the desert stuff, which a lot of Southern California is a desert outside of the kind of coastal areas. And those properties are just not really desirable, in my opinion. And some people do really well with those type of things, but it's just kind of not my thing. So I like doing larger properties. And when I say larger, at least 10 acres in kind of rural areas outside of more metropolitan areas, within an hour or two outside of a metropolitan area.
Oh, that's interesting. Why?
Yeah.
Why the rural type focus? Why such large property?
It just makes more sense to me. In the sort of land space, people have all kinds of niches that work for them. It's just the thing that's worked for me and resonated with me. It's like I understand that buyer better, I think. And I understand what we can do to increase the value on that property. I don't know. It's just something that makes sense to me. Some people focus on stuff within city limits or areas very close to a larger city where they may be dealing with lots that are a quarter acre to a half acre. And that's a whole different thing. Like an infill lot is a whole different thing than 25 acre parcel, an hour or two out of a major city. But you can make money doing both. It's just different. Like it's just a whole different thing. So
land has become real fascinating to me again over the last couple of years because I keep looking to see what's out there in inventory or see if there's a house. I'm just there's a lot of different ways I get described. If people like me, they like the attention to detail. If a vendor finds me annoying, then I'm just anal or just a pain in the butt. But my whole thing is if you're going to do something, just do it right or don't even bother. Get on my way.
Yeah.
And I'm like, gosh, I just think maybe I want to go like I originally went. I would love my 40 acres of land because it's going to be quiet. It's peaceful. And I can just turn it off at night and not be bothered. Where now I live in Midtown Reno and it's just this town never sleeps, right? There's always something going on. With the land piece, you're not limited. You just get to do what you want to do. You got your piece of property, and now you're unlimited to a certain extent. How you engineer it, the architect, the way you go with architectural, how you lay things out. You have a blank slate, so I can see how that could be really attractive for people.
Yeah, it is very attractive to a lot of people. And in some of these areas, it's pretty easy to develop and get a home site on there because a lot of these areas that we're dealing in, they're just putting a manufactured home on there and it's a pretty simple process for them. So they may be buying a 10, 25 acre parcel and we get the perk test done and they drill a well and it's a pretty easy permitting process to get a manufactured home put on there. So it's a lot different than building something in Southern California here, which may take you a couple of years of just planning before you can even break ground. So
they'll
have a house on there in 3 months.
There's a lot of barriers to entry, right, in California.
Yes. For sure.
Beautiful state. I love visiting it. I love seeing your clients and friends down in San Diego. Beautiful down there. And you're also going to pay for it. There's a price.
That's right. So that's right.
What is the best way for everyone listening? I'm really grateful you came on the show. I'm glad we're able to pull this off. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you had me on here.
And what's the best way for everyone listening to the show to reach out? Is they just want to follow what you have to write? By the way, the blog piece, that's fascinating to me. And I even go down that trail too, maybe another episode.
Another episode.
That's quite the commitment. My whole theme has been watching people on sailboats lately. I just love the ideas. Fuel has gotten so expensive. It's amazing to me up at Tahoe, over $9 a gallon to fill up the boat this summer.
Ouch.
Ski boat, and then I'm out in Annapolis. And on the water, it's like amazing. I'm saying this, only $4.50 a gallon, which is still a dollar cheaper than this on land in Reno. And I don't even want to know what it is in San Diego to fill up.
Six something a gallon, I think.
isn't that crazy? So I like sailing to me has become very interesting, although lightning terrifies me. And so I've been watching all these travel blogs. People live on their sailboats that are traveling. Pirates and lightning scare me. I don't know how rational that is on the pirates thing, but it does. And so the lightning piece, but there's a lot of effort. The videography that goes in. The story that's being told. I'm sure there's a lot of editing. And these sailboats, they look so big and roomy on TV, on YouTube, but still pretty confined quarters. And for you guys, we'll have to do another episode down the road because
you
guys doing the traveling and with that's got to be a great story in itself.
I was going to say that was a fun period in life. I think we still love to travel, just not that much.
What's the best way everyone listening to you to reach out and find out more about like what website, where can they go just to follow, see when the Turning Profit podcast gets turned on?
Sure.
Reach out to you.
Shooting for end of November to be live with a batch of episodes. And then we'll be doing 4 episodes a month at least. But you'll be able to find it at turningprofit.com. Also on there, I'm doing a monthly income report, which goes in really deep on how we're doing in our real estate investment business. So we're trying to be as transparent as possible. And this month we made this much in revenue. The gross profit was this. Here's all the deals that we completed this month. Here's how many properties we purchased, going down deal by deal. What do we learn on this? What do we learn on that? So monthly, there will be a new income report out on there. So if you go there right now, there might be an under construction sign on there, but it's almost done and we're about ready to flip the switch on it. So that's the best way to find us.
My request might not be too fair, but I'm going to be sending you a request for undeveloped property real soon.
That sounds good. I've got some I could sell you.
Hey, Pete, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And everyone listening to this podcast, I'm so grateful to be able to do this once a week. And I really appreciate everyone's support. I look forward to next week's episode on the Engineer Finance Podcast. Pete, thank you so much for coming on. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks a lot for having me, Ken. Great show and really appreciate everything.
Thank you.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. The content is intended for United States audiences only. Opinions expressed are as of the date of this publication, and such opinions are subject to change. Green Financial and Insurance Services Limited, Green, is not responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other claimed losses resulting from or related to the content presented. Green makes no representation as to the completeness or accuracy of the information presented. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. Forecasts are not a reliable indicator of future results. Investors should be aware of the risks associated with investing. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of capital. Investors should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile. Consult with a qualified financial advisor as necessary before making any investment decisions. Thank you for listening to the Engineer of Finance podcast with Ken Green.